My name is Dick Anderson. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
And I'm a member of the Macklin Group at Powder Springs, Georgia. My sobriety date is June the 8th, 1977. And I got sober by the grace of God. I actually hit my bottom in Atlanta and got sober in Louisville, Kentucky, which was my hometown. I missed a thank you last night. First of all, Gus was not here, the guy that did the logo. So, Gus, where are you? Stand up, please. And let's... And then secondly, a good friend of mine who's been staying with us for a while, we had some floods in Douglas County, Georgia, and he works with a company that does flood repairs, flood damage, but he'd been staying with us for a little while, and he did as much work as anybody because he was helping stuff the badges and carry the stuff down here, and I forgot to thank him last night, too, Irvin. Irvin, if you'll stand up. Twelve-step, this is the payoff of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came out of the advertising business, worked for a big agency up in New York. I did the Coca-Cola commercials and all of that. And on all of the we'd have a little form. I was in the creative department, so we weren't actually very disciplined. But the account executives had this form, and in it they always had product benefit. And the product benefit would be the thing that the consumer gets from buying the product. And if you buy into Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12th step is the product benefit, is what I get. It is the spiritual awakening. It's the ability to have anything of value to hand to somebody else and to find out how to live with other people. And I didn't know any of those things. And it wasn't because I wasn't given those things. I was given all of those things from the very beginning. I grew up in a house that where alcoholism, as far as we know, there's no record of any alcoholic on either side of my family for a long, long time. I am the first alcoholic of record. And I grew up in a family of honor. I grew up in a family on my dad's side of military heroes. Of that group, my name is Richard Jefferson Anderson. I've got a name for my great-grandfather, who was Richard Heron Anderson, who was a general under Robert E. Lee, a three-star general at Gettysburg. He's named for his grandfather, who was General Dick Anderson under George Washington. I'm like Lieutenant Dan, except I'm the Forrest Gump character. If Forrest Gump were devious and had a drinking problem. And for whatever reason, I couldn't connect with anything. All of the things the principles that we have in this program, when Sandy was here a minute ago and some of the things he was saying was the exact same message I've heard from preachers, from pastors, from priests, from rabbis, from anybody who's spiritual. And the way he packaged it, though, I got it. And I didn't get it when I was a kid. I could not get it. And it wasn't because I wasn't a member of anything. I was a member of the YMCA, the 4-H, Boy Scouts, Little League, all of those things. And all of them, in the Boy Scouts handbook, it says, the way we please God best is to do something anonymously, a kind act for somebody anonymously each day. And that's exactly the point of our program. And I couldn't get it. I could not get it. For whatever reason, born into this family, I felt like I didn't fit in from the very beginning. And I felt I was afraid. I felt isolated. I was alone. We have a wonderful thing in this program called a sponsor. Not only my sponsor, but other people. Bob and I had breakfast the other morning. He knows me as well as anybody. People accept me and love me even with all of my flaws. But I think that's the way God is. And I was afraid that God was somebody that was going to judge me. And that's not the way it is. It's a kind and loving God. And I didn't know that kind and loving God before I got here. So I grew up, before I ever took my first drink, feeling separated from people because I thought my dad and these heroes were a different kind of person than I was. I felt like they had something in them that I didn't have. So I felt alone. I did the things on the outside to kind of pretend like I was part of. But as the big book says, I was a player. I wasn't here. And at the same time, I felt disconnected from God. My first experience where I could feel like I was connected, you know, my spiritual compass was, I grew up in the 50s and there was television shows, and they were the Andy Griffith Show, Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, Ozzie and Harriet. and I could not connect with my Boy Scout leader, my Little League coach. I couldn't tell anybody what was going on, but I'd watch these shows. And in these shows, without judgment, when Opie or Wally got off the beam someplace, suddenly Dad would just take his pipe, turn it to one side, say something. And by the end of the show, Opie or Wally got the message, and they were back on the beam. And they became my moral compass. And then I saw my first... And they were in black and white. For those of you who are younger, TV, when it first came out in the 50s, was a little thing with a lot of snow on it, but it was black and white. And so we didn't know what color anybody's hair was. And so, but I saw my first color film in 1956 or 57. I'll go to the drive-in with my parents, and I go with my dad, the colonel, and my little sister, the later to become the retired colonel. My sister was a colonel. And so... I'm serious. And so I went to this and I saw this movie. The big book says lack of power is our dilemma. And this power that I was after, if I just had this power, I'd be like my dad or I'd be like other people and I'd be able to be okay. I'd have confidence because I'd have the power also. And so there up on the screen in Technicolor, 120 feet wide, was this movie that just screamed power. It was a movie called The Ten Commandments. And in it, there was this guy up on there, and his name was Moses, and he had a staff, and he just would take his staff and move it to one side, and his hair was blowing in the wind, and suddenly the Red Sea would part. And I felt, you know, I think, Sandy talks about the fact that we are seekers, and I have always been seeking a relationship with this power. I didn't know what it was, but this power I wanted to be part of, and I felt that, and you feel it, and it feels like it fills up your chest, and my breast was, and I was watching this movie, and I felt like I absolutely was at home. I felt at peace, and I decided that if that was power, I wanted what that guy had up there on the screen. And I made a decision. And the next day, I went down, much to the surprise of my parents, down the aisle at Linda Baptist Church to get dipped and dunked, much to the surprise of my parents, who did not know I was having a spiritual awakening at the drive-in as we were watching the Ten Commandments. And they were playing We Surrender All, or I Surrender, Barbara's the music minister, I Surrender All, and I surrendered all. I was about this tall, and all 4 feet of me walked down that aisle, convicted, and I believe that I tried to take an absolute third step that day and turn my life and will over to the care of God. I wanted to just give God my all, and I wanted to be like these other people, and I wanted to be able to smile. I wanted to have confidence. I was tired of being dark and empty on the inside and being afraid. So I turned myself over, and I did this experience, but I was like the newcomer who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, who just thinks that if we come to meetings and we just go through the motions and we talk to other people and we come and we share our issues and we share with each other. I didn't have a sponsor to tell me anything else, but because I wasn't doing anything to change, I was like that newcomer who will get discontent and go back out. I did not do anything to change. I didn't do the things that we talked about in the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th step. I didn't have steps. I didn't have a sponsor. I just had an emotional experience, but I believe also that it was a spiritual experience. I believe God was calling to me. I believe there's something in each one of us that reaches out for God and that God is reaching in for us. But I couldn't connect. I couldn't connect. And so because of that, I turned my back on God, and I thought that God wasn't going to be on my side. I thought that he didn't care for me. I thought he loved you. I thought he loved the people in the church that were smiling. But I did not think that he loved me. And I did not have my spiritual experience until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did my awakening. I didn't have a feeling that I belonged to God until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had several experiences along the way. I had 2 tours in Vietnam. I had a number of experiences where God was necessary. And if you get into trouble and if you're in combat, you try to draw close to God. And there were, I know that God saved my life on many occasions. But I just couldn't feel that connection. But I had my first spiritual experience of a nature where I felt spiritual, where I felt connected, where I felt the things that I wanted to, when I took my first drink when I was 14 years old. When I poured alcohol into my body, I felt at ease, I felt connected, I was 14 years old, And a friend of mine got us a six-pack of beer, and he got a half pint of gin. He drank the gin. I drank the beer. And I felt that same experience that I thought it made me feel like I thought Moses must have felt with that staff, because I felt at peace. I felt like I had power in my life. We went up, and from the very beginning, I wasn't a stay-at-home drunk. I was a go-to-town drunk, and we went up to hitchhike. When you're 14, that means hitchhike, and we hitchhiked up to a place called the White Castle, which is a place where you go for those little hamburgers at 2 o'clock in the morning that have all the onions on top of them, and when you're drunk. And so so we hitchhiked up to the White Castle, and we get up there, and for the first time I felt at peace with people. I was very ill at ease with people, but suddenly I'm at peace with people. And I think it's interesting that we call it distilled spirits, but it's an illusion. It's not real. And like the rest of you, it didn't last. And I drank for 13 years, from 14 until I was 27. During that time, I got arrested 22 times. I became defiant. And I think this is what we do. There's not a more defiant group on earth than the people that walk into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that what happens is, when I don't trust God and can't trust authority, and I don't really have a good relationship with people, I end up being defiant, because the only one that can take care of me and the only one that can decide anything is me. And I have learned that defiance is the opposite of humility. And humility requires faith. And I didn't understand any of those principles, none of them, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I was defiant every one of the 22 times I got locked up, except for one DUI, and I complicated that after the fact with an act of defiance, but except for one DUI, was arrested for defiance. I was the guy that if you were stopped on the side of the road and the police had stopped you, I would pull over behind there and said, "Officer, what's the problem?" And my friends love me, because after the fact, they ended up getting to go home, and I was the one in handcuffs. I got arrested for two counts of assault and battery on a police officer at my senior prom. Dad was proud. And I, now, I look and talk like this when I'm not drinking. I mean, my personality has not changed that much, but I was friendly, I was gregarious, and so forth. I didn't have the confidence I have now, but I tried to be a nice person. But as soon as I drank, there was something in me that just needed to straighten out whoever was the biggest guy or the guy with the biggest badge in the room. And that's the way I was. And it led to many adventures. And for a while, I gave into those adventures. My senior prom, when I got arrested for two counts of assault and battery on a police officer, when we have the prom in Louisville, Kentucky, we have another event. It's called the Kentucky Derby. And they invite some people in from other towns, and they all come, like a half a million of them there at the track. And so when I was in high school, because of the way I lived, I wasn't living at home. I had an apartment with some other kids, and I would go home now and then and emotionally blackmail my mom to take her to get me into the house. And so they didn't know where I was. And they wake up on Derby Day, and they find out where I was on ABC, CBS, and NBC, because the night before, even though I thought I knew all about race relations, because I knew two black people in high school and got along with them. And but that night, I'm 18, so I'm over the age of majority, and they locked me up with seven black Panthers who'd been arrested in the west end of Louisville, Kentucky, brought in explosives to blow up Churchill Downs as a statement. So the next morning on ABC, NBC, and CBS, there are seven black Panthers and me in my little powder blue tuxedo jacket. And I honestly, the thing about it is what, I think it was Bob talking about what we don't know that we don't know. I didn't even know. I thought now I was finding out the meaning of life, because I was in adventure. I'd never been on the network TV before. And so, I'm now connected. I'm thinking that I'm connected with other people. We are some of the most confused people when we get to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I kept on that way until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and eventually, you know, I had many, many opportunities. I had all kinds of opportunities. I'd get fired from one job, and I'd get hired at a better job. I was engaged 6 times, and never married. But I ended up working for an agency up in New York, and I ended up, I had been angry at God for a long, long time. Ever since somehow I made, without even thinking about it, I made that decision when I didn't get the response. You know, when you go up to a person and you try to be friends with them and they just reject you, that's the way I felt about my experience when I went down that aisle when I was a kid. And it didn't matter. And I was very angry. And I'd actually defaced one of the churches that I went to as a kid and done damage to their building. And so I get to the point, finally, like all of us do, where alcohol was no longer working. I was a daily drinker who went on binges on top of the daily. And my last 2 years of drinking, after working for the world's largest ad agency in New York, they moved me to Atlanta. My last 2 years of drinking, I was on a bathroom floor, sleeping on the bathroom floor, coming to, getting some alcohol down, dry heaving, getting enough so that I got a little buzz until I passed out again, and then coming to. That was my life my last 2 years. I was estranged from my family. I was estranged from everybody, but I was especially estranged from God. I felt absolutely lonely and dark, and then I began to think that people not only didn't care for me, that they were after me. I carried a gun with me, and I was very, very paranoid, and I heard voices coming out of the heating ducts. I had lost the ability to control my kidneys and my everything. And so I was trying to think of a delicate word, and it slipped my mind. So and that's the way I was living. And yet I thought living that way was better than being connected to anybody outside that could hurt me. And I lived by myself, and I didn't talk to anybody else. Until one day, I was evicted, and when you get evicted, and I went up to a liquor store to get that last bottle of liquor. And when I did, the guy came out and said, "I'm sorry, but we know this check is no good, and we know the last few checks you've written are no good, and we need to ask you not to come in our liquor store anymore." And so he did give me that bottle of liquor, as humiliating as that was, and knowing I was going to be living on the street, the only thought was, oh God, I hope he gives me that whiskey. And I walked with that bottle of whiskey around the corner, and it slipped out of my hands and hit some concrete, and the bottle broke. And I was more powerless and more afraid and more lonely in that one moment than I have ever been in my whole entire life. And I had nothing to fight back with. In Vietnam, even though I was afraid, I had something I could do, something I was trained to do, and I had a weapon. I had no weapon to deal with this. And I hated God on one side, but I started crying out, "God, help me, God, help me, God, help me." And this, I think, is the interesting part about this spiritual awakening. God was there all along. Anytime I'd wanted to call out for him, but I had to go through what I had to go through. And when I finally called out, a moment of peace came over me, and everything I know about life I learned in the movies. And there was a scene from Days of Wine and Roses that appeared right in front of me, and it was like magic that Sandy was talking about. And I saw Jack Klugman walking up to Jack Lemmon and saying, "I understand you need help. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous." And so I walked up to a phone booth on a street corner, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I didn't call Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't have a dime. Now, I had taken what caused me to cry out to God was when I got back, I was so angry that I pulled out this weapon and got ready to pull the trigger, and I had a bullet in the chamber, and I was that close. But what I was so angry about was that God had rejected me many years ago, and I was always the kid with the potential, and I was going to leave before I was able to do what I was put here to do. And I was so angry about that. And I was angry at God. And I cry out, and God gives me this peace. And I walk up to this phone booth, and I call. And I call the operator. And when I call the operator, somebody had done some 12-step work on her. Somebody in a committee, somewhere with a PI people. Somewhere she had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody had talked to people who were on the phone service. I don't know who it was, but that's part of the 12-step. We carry the message. And she knew to call Alcoholics Anonymous. And she connected me to an office in Atlanta where there was a woman named Helen who had just started working there about a year before. And she was the manager of Central Office. And she answered the phone, a real live person answered the phone, doing 12-step work. And if she had not answered the phone, I would not be here. And she sent out a guy named Ed. And Ed was a guy who was a railroad man, and he was not the kind I would normally associate with. He showed up, and he had on plaid pants and a striped shirt. Now, I had just temporarily, I had a wardrobe of a pair of kind of yellowish-brownish pants that were kind of, I thought they gave me a country club look, but they also were very practical. And a blue bandlon shirt and a pair of loafers that had holes in the bottom, and that's my entire ensemble. And I've actually got that in a box. Everything I owned is in a box when I came to A. But Ed sat down with me, and he had read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it shares about how we relive the horrors of our past. He did 12-step work on me. He had an awakening. He had found his peace. He had found sobriety. And he shared with me. And when he shared with me, because he shared his experience and didn't tell me what to do, and didn't criticize me and didn't judge me, I did the most complete third step I think I've ever taken. I've worked on the third step a lot since then. But I absolutely turned and said, take me. And he took me. And when he took me, he put me in his car, and it was June the 18th, 1977. It was a hot day in Atlanta. And he takes me to a place to dry out. And if Helen hadn't been there, I wouldn't be here. If Ed hadn't been willing to do a 12-step call with a wet drunk, I wouldn't be here. And if, in fact, when he took me to the place, something else would have happened that I wouldn't have been here. He stopped and he said, he was a year and a half sober. He was living in the Darlington apartments, had a small room with a hot plate, but he had a brand new car. You know how we are. And it wasn't much of a car, but it was a Pinto. And so he had me in this car. He had me in this car, but it still had the sticker on the side of it. He was proud of it. And it still had the sticker on the side of it. And, he stopped for a minute. He said, I'm going to stop here, and there's an ATM machine, and I'm going to get some money. Well, first of all, 32 and a half years ago, I'd never heard of an ATM machine. I hadn't been getting my mail, apparently. And so I didn't know anything about it. And I said, what is that? And he said, I take this card and put it in this machine and get money. And the thought was, well, if I had one of those cards, I wouldn't have had to call Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm in the middle of a miracle. I'm in the middle of the biggest miracle of my life, and I'm thinking about ways out of it. And because I really don't want, I don't want this thing that Sandy was talking about. I mean, it's amazing how hard we work not to get all the wonder and glory and joy of life. But we work hard at it. And so anyway, when he said, will you be okay? He walked out to use this card, and while he was gone, I threw up down the inside of his car. Brand new sticker. And he came back, and the only thing he did was put his arm around me and said, it's okay. It's going to be okay. Because he knew that we don't have cars. We don't have even a hot plate in a room at the Darlington without our ability to carry the message to help another alcoholic, the ability to put them before us. And so I turned my life completely over to this guy. And from that day until now, I have never been without a group of men that were willing to do anything and everything at any hour of the day to make sure that I stayed sober. But more than that, I got a group of men that also were willing to tell me the truth. And from the very beginning, I was blessed with going to, I didn't have a home in Atlanta. I was from Louisville, so I moved back to Louisville. They assigned me a sponsor. He was a railroad man named Jack Sullivan. I got back there. And when I got back there, they put me I went to 10 meetings a week, and 9 of them were speaker meetings, and our conversations took place at the Howard Johnson's after the meeting. And the other meeting was a big book meeting where somebody who had experienced it read the big book. We could ask questions and so forth. There was no time at which I ran my program. They didn't allow that. I could have tried, but I was blessed with that. And if you heard the message throughout this whole weekend, speaker meetings and meetings where we carry the real message and the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous are very, very important to people being able to find this spiritual awakening. Now, so I have not had a desire for a drink from the day that, in without knowing it, I just cried out to God and said, "Help me." From that day until now, where for 14 years I couldn't stay away from a drink more than a couple hours, I haven't even had the desire to take a drink. But it was a while in the program before I realized what had happened. And that was part of my spiritual awakening, the realization that this was there. The second thing that I did, they told me that what I had to do was clean house and change. I had to work the house cleaning steps. And so we did an annual house cleaning, but in the beginning I did three the first year. I had brain damage. It took me about a year and a half to learn how to read. So with brain damage, you can't remember much. And so I didn't have much on any of my inventories. But when I finally got to, and nobody poo-pooed me. If you're here and you can't understand what anybody's saying this weekend, get a job in Alcoholics Anonymous. My job, in my home group, they wouldn't let me do anything that it required much thinking because I did have a little malfunction going on. And so at that time, if you came into AA in Louisville and you didn't smoke, it was mandatory that you learned how to smoke. And so I was the ashtray guy, and I cleaned those little ashtrays that were round metal. They were red, green. They looked like Christmas colors. They were red, green, blue, and gold. And I cleaned them up, and I was a good ashtray guy. And I felt more value in being a member of that group and being the ashtray guy than I had of being the youngest vice president, McCann Erickson, up in New York. Because it was real, and I belonged. And it didn't matter to you that I would cry in the wrong places or laugh in the wrong places or ask questions that didn't make any sense, where people would just, sometimes I'd ask a question and everybody would look at each other and they'd say, yeah, it's going to be okay. Because they had no answer to some of the questions that I had because I wasn't sure what I was asking. And that's the way they treated me. So I was trying to do these steps, but I couldn't really do them. And then my mind started to open up a little bit after a year, and I got through all of the things. And I was, if you grow up like I did, absolutely defiant. How can you possibly, and especially angry at God, how can you possibly connect with anybody? How can you be connected with man or God? I couldn't. And so I shared these things, and I got them all out, and I was resentful at everybody. And then I got into the miracle step, and those were the amends. And I started making amends. And here's what happened. I went back to that church, and some people come in, and they want to find a totally new religion. They want to find a totally new life. I think that's great. But go back. If you've been married, or you are married, before you start dating, you ought to deal with the relationship you're in. And I had to go back to the church I belonged to when I was a kid, to that Linda Baptist church where I'd walked down the aisle and I felt God rejected me. And I went there on a Sunday night and I told them that I was sorry that I had said a lot of things about them and that I wanted to volunteer for a couple of years to do something around the church just to make amends. And as a result of me doing a simple process, now I'm just doing the step, God did two things, two dramatic things, did a number of things, but the first thing he did was, those people loved me like people do in AA. They came out unconditionally. That was my second Christmas, and I didn't have enough money to go to Mississippi to see my parents. And they took up some money and paid for me to go to Mississippi. What I started to see and feel were acts of God through people to me. And I was starting to realize this was God. We realized that God was doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. The second thing that happened that night was there was a beautiful young blonde that was there. She was two things I wasn't looking for. She was a seminary student and a good girl. I was kind of looking for a new dancer who needed spiritual guidance. But because I was doing what God asked me to do, God introduced me to this girl, and that girl was one of your speakers this weekend and has been my wife for 25 years, Barbara. It's like Sandy was talking about. If I'm doing a few simple things that I can understand, because I can't understand what the master can understand, I can't direct the show. But if I do my little parts, which is clean my life up, then God takes care of the details. And I met my partner and my soulmate because I was doing a ninth step at a church that I had. Now, I made amends to the last amend that I made out of that group of amends was to another church where I'd actually defaced it when I was in high school. And I walked in, and I couldn't find anybody in the office, and I couldn't find anybody in the chapel. I couldn't find anybody any place. And I went into that chapel, And I realized who I was there for. I had been asking God every morning to keep me sober and thanking God every night. And I really was not comfortable with God. I had a lot of hatred towards God for the things that I thought God had done to me. I was there to forgive God. And even though God had not done anything to me and didn't deserve me to forgive him, it was an act I had to do to get free so I could be forgiven. Because at the end of this meeting, we will say, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And that's exactly what I did. And I got down on my knees and I started telling God that I was sorry for blaming him all those years. And that whatever feelings I had, I wanted to let go of. And I had one of the most profound spiritual experiences I've ever had. I felt like I weighed nothing. I felt like there was a breeze that was blowing through me. And I felt like, for the first time, I was connected with God. Now, here's what you did for me. Here's what Alcoholics Anonymous did for me. When I first came into AA in that place up in Louisville, I couldn't work. So I stayed in somebody's basement where they had an extra bed, and I was able to work with the wet drunks one at a time. And each of those drunks, I'd work with for 2 or 3 days. If you've ever worked with a lot of wet drunks, you work with them for 2 or 3 days. I had DTs for 4 days. They'll have DTs 3, 4 days. After you get them out of the DTs, then usually when they get to feel a little bit better, they take off and you don't see them again. And I would get irritated at them. But it was pointed out to me that I was staying sober while they were doing that. And when my eyes started to open up a little bit, I started to realize that I was, in fact, loving unconditionally these alcoholics. While at the same time, I'd go to my parents' house where I was trying to make amends to my dad, and if he said the wrong thing, I'd leave. I had to learn how to love people unconditionally in Alcoholics Anonymous before I could love people outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you taught that to me. And I said, what AA was doing for me was teaching me how to love people unconditionally. It was reconnecting me with people. It was reconnecting me with God. And if you're connected with God and people, you have joy. And that's something I never had before. I had occasional moments of happiness, occasional, certainly lots of highs, but I never had joy. For the first 12 years of Alcoholics Anonymous, I spent a great deal of time doing everything you asked me to do. I felt connected to people. I felt some connection to God. I felt that I was a valuable member. But I did what some of the people up here have been talking about, us sharing our viewpoint of what the Big Book says, and this is how you should see it. And that's the way I worked with the guys I sponsored. That's the way I worked with other people. I thought that because I had 10, 12 years, I had some kind of authority in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a DCM back then. I did all these things. And I felt like I was growing and achieving and getting some seniority in AA and so forth. But I was still fighting everybody and everything. And if there's anybody in this room who's been here for a while and you still feel like you're fighting everybody and everything, then the reason for that was I had not gone on to look at the second and third sides of that triangle. I just hadn't gotten them. I didn't know anything about the traditions. Even though I was in the middle of service, I knew about how we practice traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't know how we practice the concepts, and I didn't really know how we practice those on a spiritual level. And so I ended up between 12 and 15 years. When I was 12 years sober, I got burned out, and I went through a period where I absolutely felt like I was disconnected, and I felt like I would go to an AA meeting. I would look at people in the meeting. I would start to criticize this person. I would say, that person always says the same thing, and I would look around the room, and I would get very, very agitated at people. I felt uncomfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started going to less meetings. I started, because I was acting like a jerk, and at this point, when I was 10 years sober, and 3 years married, and I was sponsoring a guy and trying to help him with his marriage, he pointed out that I might want to work on my own marriage because I wasn't treating Barbara very well. And I realized I didn't know how to be a husband. All these things were going on, and here I am 12 years sober. And so I started burning out. And Bill Roop had been my sponsor from the time I got to Atlanta until that time, and I stopped calling him. And I call him, you know, every month, and every 2 months, and every 3 months. And finally, I wasn't calling him at all. And I was barely going to meetings. And I found myself in a hotel room in Los Angeles when I was 15 years sober, trying to find a gun so I could put a bullet in my head. And this is at 15 years sober. And because of that, I cried out to God, and I said, God, help me. I don't know what to do this time. And so he sent me to 8 meetings that were out there on the West Coast, and the first one Tom Whalen spoke at and talked about having a burnout when he was in his 20s. And the next one was Cliff Roach and talked about having a burnout after he'd been here for a while. So if you have been here for some time and you're going through burnout, that's not abnormal. But here's what I did about it. I came back. I was embarrassed to call Bill because I hadn't been talking to him. And again, I had a great deal of pride, and I didn't want to let him know what I'd been doing and how badly I'd been doing. So I got a new sponsor, John Holmes. And I called him because I was seeing him all the time. And I got John. Obviously, Bill's got 52 years. He wasn't having a problem. I was having a problem. And John's got 50 years. He wasn't having a problem. But so I got John as a sponsor, and I started working. And John looked, and we spent an hour talking. He said, you're in the middle of a spiritual wasteland. And that's exactly where I was. I was in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, a place that just where this kind of love and where this kind of energy flow, everything that's been coming from this weekend has been a gift flowing to us. And I wasn't able to take it. So I started over. And I started by going to a meeting and not saying anything. And of course, I was going to speaker meetings and other meetings, but any meeting I went to, I didn't say anything. I didn't try to be the person who had the solution. I was looking. I started as a student again. And the second thing that I did was I started really studying the traditions, and I started studying the concepts. And I can tell you that Bill Wilson, if you watch his career and look at where he came from, during Alcoholics Anonymous, most of the literature we have came out of his needs. When the fellowship looked like it was going to fall apart, he developed the traditions. When he himself was having a lot of problems with his own ability to act nice to other people and not to have to be the big shot, came his article on emotional sobriety. And emotional sobriety was what I was missing. I was here, I was going to meetings, I was taking people to meetings, I was 12-stepping people, but I had no emotional sobriety, and I didn't know how to get it, and I'm going to share with you what I learned when I was studying the traditions. And I started studying the traditions on my own. I went to traditions meetings. It's hard to find a tradition meeting. We do workshops when we go to conferences. We call them How to Play Nice with Others or Living in the Principles. Everybody comes. We were doing the same workshop up in Connecticut at the Connecticut State Conference a couple of months ago, and they insisted, because it was a state conference, to call it the Traditions Workshop. We had 11 people there, and there were 2,000 people when I spoke. True, true. So don't call it the Traditions. Just share the principles. But I'm going to go through these real quickly. But here are the basic principles that we talk about when we're sharing these principles: are humility, knowing who has the power, that one is God, becoming obedient. There is no promise in the big book that doesn't require us to follow the dictates of a higher power. It doesn't say follow the suggestions of a higher power. It says follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, regardless of your present circumstances, whether it's Katrina or cancer. You'll presently live in a new and wonderful world. We had a new employer. To the extent that we kept close to him and performed his work well, he provided what we needed. Every promise in there doesn't require that I go to meetings and read the big book. They require that I ask God what I should do, that I follow God. And if I follow God by doing something simple as going and doing a ninth step, I get a wife. I get a wonderful life. And I'll go through these real quickly. The first tradition is about unity, and that's the basis of all of it. We before me. When Barbara and I have an argument and we can't agree upon it, we stop and we pray with each other and we let go of it, or we try to let go of it. We may still be angry at each other as we walk away, but we try to let go of it. when Tom Ivester, when Keith, my best friend Keith Lewis died a couple of years ago, and when Keith died, I had to put together a memorial service, and did it at Sandy's Church, and along with Tom Ivester and John Holmes were the three sponsors of Keith Lewis. And we set it up for a particular date that Tom had, and I called Tom to confirm that date, and Tom said, well, wait a minute, I think I've got brain surgery that day. He did. He had an aneurysm on his brain they were going to operate on. And he called me back and he said, I've moved my brain surgery so we can have the memorial for Keith. He said, we do that for the greater good. And that's what Tom does. That's what the guys that I follow do. So unity is we before me. The only way that I will accept we before me is if I think some power is going to take care of me. Because for me to let go and let the greater good happen, I have to believe that there's some power that's going to take care of me. And that's answered in the second tradition. The second tradition basically says that there is only one power, and we're not it. That one of the biggest freedoms I've found in Alcoholics Anonymous that allows me to live these principles is to know that God has all power. If God has all power, that means how much power do I have? None. But how much power do you have? None. If you have no power, you can't hurt me. And all my life I'd been afraid of what you could do to me. And so by turning my life over to this power, I have to actually trust that power. I have to develop some faith in that power. But slowly, one step at a time, when I cried out to God and God brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and then when I went to make amends to this church and God gave me a wife, one after another, if you start counting the miracles, they add up in a hurry. And when I give God credit on my own experience for what he's done for me, then I begin to understand that there is a God that is kind and loving and that he loves me with all his heart. And when I had that experience where I sat there in that church and the wind blew through my heart, what I realized was, and the gift to me that day, was that God loves me. This is my spiritual awakening, as simple as this. There is a God, he loves me, and he loves me as a child. And shortly after that experience that we had, that I had in that church, I went to do this annual house cleaning with these guys at Gethsemane. And there was a priest there. And this priest came out and talked to us, and he said, you men talk about God's will all the time. And we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. So he said, what do you think God's will is? And none of us had an answer. And he said, God's will is simply to do the best you can one day at a time with what God gives you. No more, no less. If you're a father, be a good father. If you're a son, be a good son. If you're a brother, be a good brother. If God got you sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, be the best member you can possibly be. If you have a job right now that you love and you're good at it, do it with honor and give it to other and give to other people through that job until God gives you something else to do. If you have a job that you absolutely hate, do it with honor and love until God gives you something else to do. And he said, God sees us as his children, and he loves us more than we love our children. If you men had two boys and they were both 12 years old and you gave each one of them a red wagon, and one of them took that red wagon around the neighborhood and spread joy to everybody, and the other one took that red wagon and kicked it aside and said, I want a scooter, who would you give more to? And I had always been the one who took whatever you gave me, kicked it aside, and wanted something else. I was never content to use what you gave me, and I certainly wasn't focused on using what you gave me to help others. What Sandy was just talking about was the joy that comes into our life when we're useful to others. There's a feeling that I get of connection, of joy, of love when I reach out, when I talk to Barbara. And I went to visit somebody three nights ago. No, it was longer than that, a week or so ago, who had just been in a coma, induced coma, to help her get out of the seizure she was going through coming off of alcohol and pills. And 2 days out of that, we went to call on her, and she still was not sure why she couldn't drink. But because we were able to carry the message with her, or is Jimmy Mooney still around here? She's at Willing Way now. And she agreed to go to Willing Way, and she started a new life. the power for us to go, and I want to see her. I want to see what happens in her life. Our ability to be useful gives me some new, whole new purpose and gives me something called joy that I did not have before. The third tradition is about acceptance without judgment. And all of us do that. Am I judging others? If I walk into an AA meeting and I judge somebody else, it comes back on me. Why? Who am I to judge? God loves each one of us. I have no idea what your purpose is. Keith is my best friend, and when he started to get Lou Gehrig's disease, he was difficult to talk to, and he would be angry. And on one trip, we were supposed to go together, and I'd set up the whole trip, and I was excited about it. It was going to be a road trip. We're speaking out in Arizona. I did all the details. You know, I did all the work, and I wanted him to like the job I did on the trip. And so we're ready for this trip, and Keith called and canceled at the last minute. So I wanted to talk to Keith about that. His behavior had been very poor for about 6 months. So I wrote this little note. You know how we write notes? Because I wanted to have a talk to him because I was concerned about his behavior. You know how we're concerned about people in Alcoholics Anonymous? So I'm not kidding you. These are 2 pages of notes that I wrote to have a conversation with Keith. Number one, concern. He seemed irritable and discontent, depressed, seemed angry at me, angry at a lot of things and people in the world. When we talked about the trip, he let me know there would only be one way to do it, and we could just go straight there, You know. Anyway, the point of this is my resentment out on paper as a concern so that I can help my friend out of my concern, etc. And I'm judging my friend. And then what I did was, instead of me deciding to do it, I went to God and I said, okay, God, what's going on here, before I talked to him? And the thought came to me, Keith wouldn't be acting like this, because Keith was a wonderful man. And I didn't know he had Lou Gehrig's disease, and he had dementia, and his brain was starting to work differently. And he was treating me very differently. He was treating Julia, his wife, very differently. If I had shared that with me, I would not have been in the room with Keith and had the experience I'm going to share when I close. The fifth tradition is, what is my purpose? What is our purpose? I'm not going to achieve my purpose. When Barbara and I got married, my purpose for our relationship was for her to be a good-looking blonde and to be with me, and we'd have a good time and would look good when we got out and have a little loving and be friends, and I would be her provider. That's about how shallow I was when we got married, and I was in the program for a number of years. Today, the purpose of our relationship is for she and I to have a safe harbor to go to where we will love each other unconditionally, even when we have a bad day in AA, in life, any place else, to love each other unconditionally, to pray with each other, and also, because we're both on the same path, to hold each other accountable and to support each other in that path and that purpose, to make sure that we're not doing our own will but doing God's will. And we can achieve that purpose. The sixth tradition is about I have more than enough to do without minding other people's business. This is about not endorsing finance, lending outside, but it's minding other people's business. I spent years trying to get back with my dad. Then I go have a conversation with him. We start talking about politics. We get in an argument, and I'd leave. When's the last time you changed somebody's mind about Iraq, abortion, anything else? We just don't change their mind. And what's the point of doing it? It's inefficient. It's not... My idea of spirituality now is that if I am efficient, being able to be useful to somebody else. Even gossip. The last thing that Dr. Bob said was, let us remember to guard that erring member of the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. The seventh tradition is freedom from bondage. This is an area where I'm tremendously bad. I'm not a good money manager at all, and we've had bondage. Whoever you owe is who you work for. If you owe a lot of money, you're working for those people. And how can you go do God's will if he asks you to do it if you work for somebody else? I had a new employer. The idea of getting out of bondage is I've got a new employer. God's my employer. I'm free to go where I'm supposed to go. Eighth tradition is about doing my job. When do I need help? Knowing my purpose. Again, the ninth tradition is about keep it simple, letting go and letting God, seeking wise counsel. The 10th tradition about how opinions can get us off purpose. The 11th tradition is, and this is the most misunderstood, I misunderstood these totally. I thought anonymity was about not protecting us. It's not at all. The 11th tradition is about actions speak louder than hype. On page 83 of the Big Book, it says that a man will judge us by our actions, much more than our words. When I was... 10 years ago. Steve, how long have you been sober now? Yeah, 10 years. Okay, so somewhere about 9 years ago, I'm sponsoring Steve, and his wife was not that happy that I was sponsoring him. She wasn't that happy. He was in AA in the very beginning. And I go into a cell phone store, and I explain to the cell phone people in there that my cell phone's not working. I bought it from them, so it was a little defective, and back then they didn't have packages, and because of the fact that that I had to make 10 phone calls because he kept dropping the phone calls, I had to pay 10 times as much for the service. And so what I needed was a new phone because the phone was defective and I needed them to change my bill. And she didn't seem to agree with that. And I sometimes go on the theory that if you don't agree with what I'm sharing with you, you're hard of hearing. So I share it a little louder. So 2 weeks later, I'm sitting with my pigeon, Steve, and he says, "By the way, did you go in a cell phone store the other day?" And I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "Well, my wife was working next to the woman you were talking to, and she said you made her cry." Now, I didn't make her cry. We're all friends now, but I didn't make her cry. At that point, she was of the opinion she was looking for a fault, but I didn't make her happy, I can tell you that much. And all I had to do was ask for the manager, because once I did, he did exactly what I asked. So what I learned from that is that every place I go, no matter where I am, the way I should act is as though somebody I'm sponsoring is watching me. That means I don't get time off. If you go by a massage parlor and see a honk if you love Bill W. sign out front. If you cut in front of somebody in traffic and it says let go and let God, and you're giving them the finger as you let go and let God, so you pull in front of them. Any of my actions that I do anywhere, if they're not something that a pigeon would want to see or that my sponsor would want to see, then I probably shouldn't be doing it. Now, can I live up to that standard? No. But it gives me something to shoot for. And if I'm at peace, if I'm connected with God, I'm much less likely to be agitated. Now, it doesn't mean I don't get agitated, but it's much less likely to be agitated. And the 12th tradition is really probably the most misunderstood. It's the spiritual, anonymity is the spiritual foundation. That means we give credit where credit's due. There are great, great people in Alcoholics Anonymous and people that I listen to. When I came out of DTs after 4 days, they put a tape. I was in a bathrobe and slippers. They put a tape in a tape player, and I listened to a tape of a guy named Sandy B. And for the first time in my life, I laughed. First time since the alcoholism had gotten that bad, I laughed. And Sandy B is one of the guys that helped save my life. But I don't think he's God. And I don't think he has any power. I think he has access to the power. And they put me on a little bus. And I heard what I needed to hear out of that tape. I heard Marine Corps, and I heard he was an idiot in slippers and a thing when his sponsor came to pick him up. It was the drop the rock. If I'd heard Harvard, I might not have Yale. He'd be offended by it. If I heard Yale, he might not be. I might not have connected. But I heard what I needed to hear. And when I was 2 weeks sober, they put me on a little bus and took me to a meeting. And there was a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. So those are the first two guys I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I heard Chuck probably 20 times during the next few years before he passed away. And that was a great gift to me. And I didn't realize what a gift it was to me. And I was hearing the message, and what I was hearing was that God was there. And things did start to change for me. And I started to practice after I'd been in the program for a while, these traditions, and learned about the concepts, and I started to be more gentle with other people. And once that happened, everything took off. Suddenly I got involved in service. I was on the roundup committee. All of these things started to happen because I was willing to be of use to somebody. And I will share with you the power of the program and as I close here. In 2005, Barbara and I put our dog to sleep. She talked about that the other day. And he was our child. We hadn't had children. And we thought that that was one that it really, because this dog, you know how dogs are, they're unconditional, and this was a great dog. And we cried, and I buried him out back. And we didn't know that we could grieve any more than that. And within just a few weeks, Barbara's mom and dad, for whom we were caretakers, both passed away within a week of each other unexpectedly. And he had Alzheimer's, and when he died, his wife, I think, just had a broken heart and didn't want to be here without him. And she wanted to be in paradise with him. And we could have looked at that two different ways. One was to look at it like this is a loss. The other is to look at this as a gift, that God was waiting for his children to go home. And their bodies were worn out, and they wanted to go together, and they went with in God's time just like that. And we went to Toronto and came back, and I was told that I had esophageal cancer. And esophageal cancer has the worst recovery rate of any of the cancers, worse than pancreatic. And I felt like my inside had been ripped out, and I was afraid again. And I hadn't had fear in a long time. And I tried to pray, and I almost couldn't pray. But people started doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And we found a place where they could do this operation, remove part of my stomach, take all my esophagus out, take almost everything out of my chest, put a tube up in my chest to replace it, go through a lengthy process of learning how to use that as a digestive system, because it's like a transplant, it takes a while for it to start working, be on a feeding tube for a while, all of this. And this was going to be my solution, and they could do this out at the University of Southern California. And I couldn't tell Barbara, because she just lost her mom and dad, that I had cancer. So I told her, you know how we are. I mean, I can justify these half-truths in Alcoholics Anonymous even now. This is just a few years ago in 2005. So I told her that I had precancerous tissue that needed to be removed. And that's true. I did have precancer, because the rest of the cancer tissue in my esophagus was precancerous. So it was going to be removed. I just forgot the cancer part when I talked to her. So I didn't bring this up, and I could only tell a couple of people. I told my prayer partner, Keith Lewis. I told another guy that I prayed with, Ed Mutum. And I told my sponsor. And I couldn't tell you because you don't gossip. And so Barbara didn't really know until a couple of days out. And so they take us up to, we're working on me going out to USC. And right before I was to go down to speak at Key West on a Saturday night, I got a phone call, and they said, "We can't take your insurance. And so we'll need you to put together," I think it was $250,000. I didn't have $250,000. And they wouldn't take me otherwise. And I got so angry. And I was back, this is after 30 years or 29 years, whatever I had at that point in the program. I was back at that point where I was not connected with God, because I was angry and I felt apart from God. Because I had found the place. And I had found a solution. And they told me I had to have this operation within a couple of weeks. And I'm going to die because I don't have the right insurance. And I went to Key West, and I couldn't pray for 2 days. And one of the guys there said, "Just say whatever prayer you remember from youth." And I said the 23rd Psalm. And I started saying it over and over. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." And it's a pretty good prayer if you're in trouble. And something broke right before I went up to speak on that Saturday night. And I had this vision of my original sponsor, Jack Sullivan, this railroad man, who had 6 malignant brain tumors. And I was talking to him on the phone the day he came out of the doctor's office. And he said, he's telling me about it. And I said, "Jack, you don't seem like you have any fear." And he said, "If God has been this good to me here, just imagine what he's got waiting on the other side." And I got up and spoke that night, and I felt free. The big book says we lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. And if I'm not afraid to make the big trip, if I realize that God loves me here, and on the other side he's got a paradise with all this human fall draw that we go through here and all the struggle, then what am I afraid of? And I relaxed, and I was ready to go. And I came back, And on Monday, we got a phone call from USC, and they said, we still can't take you, but our chief surgeon just went to a hospital in New York City. I mean, in Rochester, New York. And if you call him up there, maybe they can do something for you. So I can't even get my primary care provider on the phone, so I'm going to call the chief surgery at Rochester, New York. But I called. I didn't have much choice. So I called, and an hour later, the chief of surgery calls me back and says, we don't care about your insurance. We'll take you. Come on up. Get here as fast as you can. So I told Barbara that I actually had cancer, and she and I left for Rochester, New York. And this is a place that we didn't know anything about. We made a couple of phone calls to some other AA people. And we thought it was going to be fairly lonely. And also, Barbara, being from the South, if you're from the South, you really don't want to go to Rochester, New York, especially if your great-granddaddy was General under Robert E. Lee, you don't want to go to Rochester, New York to make your exit. But we drive up there, and when we got to the hotel, there were two people there, and they took us to meet 30 other people. And that first night, we had a home group in AA and Al-Anon. And these people took care of Barbara day in, day out. They did her laundry. They took her. They got her away from the hospital so she didn't go crazy while I'm walking around. And the next day we went to that hospital. We walked into the chapel to pray to make sure we were in the right place. And there on the wall, in letters that were a foot and a half deep, in gold, it said, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. And we knew we were in the right place, and we walked out into the lobby to see exactly where we were. It was Strong Memorial Hospital in Rochester, New York, endowed by Dr. Leonard Strong, who was Bill Wilson's brother-in-law, who helped start the Alcoholic Foundation, without whom I wouldn't have been here in the first place. Like Sandy says, God takes care of all the details. See, I was praying for my will to be done with God's help. God is the one who has all power. So I should ask God where I should go. And God, in his own gentle way and with a sense of humor and with a big flair for drama, I thought the Dr. Leonard Strong thing was just... You know, I'm a writer. I try to make up stuff. I can't make up stuff like that. So we go out in the lobby, and there, and we knew we were there. We knew God was in the middle of this. I don't think that we felt absolutely surrounded in prayer, just like the people now that are praying for Tony, who was here Thursday night, and the people who are praying for Brookins and his family. They will feel surrounded in prayer. And the only thing that keeps me from feeling that sense of being connected with God, that conscious contact, is if I behave in such a way that it is against the principles I know God wants me to live by. And then God hasn't left. I've cut off my sensor. I can't feel God. I can't feel God. But even in the middle of that, if your heart is right and you really are committed to doing what God asks you to do and you love God, that's the main thing, is what I've come to do in Alcoholics Anonymous that helps me. It's my spiritual awakening. It helps me to carry the message, because we carry the message by the way we live much more than by the way we go and pick up people. In the beginning, it's going and picking up people, and we still do that. And we had to go over and sit in a hospital for a couple hours with this girl the other day. You do that. But it's what you carry inside of you. It's the spirit that sits inside of you. If there is a spirit of God, people will see that. They want to be connected to you. They don't even know what it is, and they want to be connected to you. And it's not me. And it's not Bob. And it's not Sandy. And it's not Tom. And it's not Ralph. And it's not Michael. And it's not Linda. And it's not Barbara. It's God. That's what we've been looking for all our lives. And I'm going to tell you about my best friend and how he lived the last couple of weeks, a few weeks of his life. And this will tell you what a man. He's the most obedient person that I knew. And he was the person that I knew that spent more time trying to get close to God. His name was Keith Lewis. If you haven't listened to him, listen to his tape. He and I were on the phone 6-7 times a day. And during his last couple of years, he got to the point where I'd call him up. Normally, we'd have these long chats. Say, hey, how you doing? Good. Click. He just lost his ability to have a conversation. He'd say, I'm doing fine, click, and he'd hang up, and he'd think the phone conversation was over. And we got to the point where we couldn't very well communicate, and people were confused by him, and he got angry at people because of his situation. And people kind of turned their back on him to some extent. And in his own home group, he'd walk up and do inappropriate things and talk to people at the wrong time and talk during the speaker. And so people just, you know, some of the people who didn't know him and didn't know his heart didn't treat him very well. And I went down to spend a little over a week with him, 6 weeks before he died. And here's what Keith did. And especially if you know his story, this makes this, you understand this. He got up. Here's a guy who's shuffling, who was down to 128 pounds, whose only favorite word was God. He wanted more than anything in the world to be close to God. He wanted to go home to God. He wanted to tell you about God. He shared that every time he got to the podium. And Keith was there, and he would get up in the morning, and he would go and pray for people for an hour. And then he would come back. He was Catholic, and he would make rosary beads. And if his story, he made rosary beads with 13 beads when he was a kid, to be defiant. But now he's making with the right number of beads. And he made them for the Air Force, the Army, the Marines, and the Navy. And he sent them over there to the troops. And then he, after he did that, he would go to, he always went to Walmart for lunch because he could get there and he'd get the special, because that, you know, decisions start becoming a problem when you've got dementia. And then he would come back, and he would go and pray again for an hour in the afternoon. Then he would make more beads. Then he would pray for another hour, then go to dinner with his wife each night, and sometimes she would take him to a meeting. And I said, well, who are you praying for? Because he had trouble with some things, but other things he understood. And I said, who are you praying for? He said, I'm praying for the newcomers who walk into Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he listed people he knew needed prayer. In the middle of his body being taken over by the ravages of Lou Gehrig's disease, he was focused on praying for you for 4 hours a day. Everything about his life was to be useful to you. And from being with him, I was making more and more, and from being around the people that are here this weekend, I was making more and more commitments and have over the past 2 years to try to be useful to you, because there is great joy in that usefulness. The joy, regardless of anything that's going on in our life, even if we're trapped in a body like that, even if I have terminal cancer, is that God loves me, God loves you, and that whatever happens, we're going to a better place, and we've got a beautiful place, that paradise on earth, if we carry it around inside, just by being useful. And if I had given that letter to Keith, I'm trying to find right now the thing I wrote his obituary, and if I had given that letter to Keith, I would not have had the experience I'm about to describe. Because Keith, unlike me when I was praying for my will over my cancer and then got God's will, Keith all along was praying for God's will, even in the middle of this terrible disease. So he was doing that every day for others. And when it finally came time to the hospice, I was in the room with him, and Sandy and John, his two sponsors that were there at that time, left, his younger brother. Denny, if you ever heard him talk on his tape, Dumb Denny, his sister Patty, they were all there. They all left at 11:30. Julia, his wife, was there. She asked me to stay, and there was a Eucharistic minister in the room. And the Eucharistic minister was continuing to pray some kind of liturgy. Julia had been up for 3 days, and suddenly in that room, there was this tremendous spirit. For the whole 2 days, 3 days we were in the hospice, we were in there, and Keith kept talking about going to see God. And he was saying goodbye to us, but he wanted to go see God. This loving spirit that pulls us all along was calling him home. But what he was praying for was God's will. And when I want God's will and I'm praying for it, that's when I have harmony, that's when I have joy, that's when I have peace. And he's asking for it. And at 11:30, when they left, I was sitting there holding a crucifix and holding Keith's hand. Julia got up, walked around, sat down, and laid next to her husband and put her head on his. And this, I can't explain it any other way than this tremendous spirit started to fill the room. And it was almost like a bubble. It was like this power that just overtook us. And at the end of that hour, we were actually giddy and giggling with joy, because there was so much joy in that room. And as we watched Keith's body stop and take its last breath, we felt not only God's presence, but Keith's presence. And they were both in that room with us for a period of time, and then just left. This is the way I described it. In a room filled with peace and those who loved him, Keith Lewis gently fell asleep at 12:30 a.m. November 15th, 2007, to awaken to the paradise promised by the God he loved so much. His wife, Julia, was cuddled next to her loving husband as family and friends prayed him into his new journey. The sense of joy in the room was unexplainable, unless you knew Keith. God certainly loves his children. He loves me. He loves you. It's not that complicated. It's pretty simple. And all you have to do is seek him. Thank you.